Yes, hi everyone, and welcome to a Fox Football podcast looking at the Socceroos and the World Cup qualification, international friendly, and a look ahead at the Confederations Cup in Russia, where the side has just jetted off to play Germany, Chile, and Cameroon in a massive test over the next couple of weeks. David Wiener with you here for a special discussion alongside with two colleagues of mine who have been on the road with the Socceroos in Adelaide and Melbourne over the last week. Regular podcaster Daniel Garb, welcome back.
Thank you, Davey. A little breakout podcast today, but certainly a pertinent one. It's been a very big week and a big week ahead.
Yeah, lots to discuss. And welcome to the podcast room, the podcast studio, the bunker we've got here for the first time to one of the great young voices in Australian football. Kate Cohen's been in Melbourne. She said she was watching the Socceroos. I've got a feeling she was just watching Philippe Coutinho for 3 days straight. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. I am a Liverpool tragic, and what an honour to be called up to this glorious podcast room. I'm in the seat of Simon Hill, so hopefully I can do it justice.
All right, we're going to cut straight to it because this has been a really interesting week and a couple of months for the Socceroos, where I feel like there's as much discussion about the national team as there's been for some time. And it's not just been within the football fraternity, it's cut into the mainstream where performances have been vexing and polarizing. Results have been okay. We're still on track to get to Russia. But there's as much discussion as there's ever been on both sides of the fence. And that's what we want to cut through today, is the myth and reality, the hysteria and the truth of where we're at. And there's so many different ways we can get to it. So I just want to start with just general statements. Gabby, to you first, from your observations. And you were in camp for a couple of days in Adelaide, so you got to watch them from close quarters. And not just the two games. How do you assess the last week? Can you look at it in terms of pass or fail and your concern or calmness heading into these three big games?
Has to be a pass because we beat Saudi Arabia. Simple as that. That was the game that mattered. Yeah, Brazil was slightly disappointing. But, you know, he also left out several key players in that side. You take out Aaron Moy, you take out Tom Rogic, you take out Matt Ryan, who's number one. You take out Tommy Juric, who's now the number nine. He's got that nailed down, you would say, for at least the start of the Confeds Cup. So you rotate things that much, and it's going to upset the apple cart, especially against a team who was energized and motivated in Brazil. You could sense that, Kate. We watched Brazil training the day before. There was no messing around there. They were out there to prove a point. So you do that, and you had to do that to get minutes into the legs of players, and you're going to come unstuck because we know there's a gulf in class. That can't be denied. But we beat Saudi Arabia. That's the most important thing. Yes, the first half was disappointing. The second half I thought was very good. I mean, we won the second half 1-0. Stonewall penalty denied. Tommy Juric misses a sitter. It could have been 4 or 5-2, really, in the end. So you look at it that way, and the fact that really destiny is in Australia's hands now in regards to qualification because of that Japan result against Iraq. We get really a draw and a win considering Japan play Saudi Arabia in the final game, and we're there automatically. So you take stock of it in that sense, and it's a pass for me because the main job was done. So there's a lot of things to pick at, and those points are certainly very valid. But overall, they're in a better position than they were when they started this week.
Kate, what did you think?
Yeah, absolutely spot on. This time last week, when we were heading into the Saudi Arabia game, that was when there was real cause for, is there going to be question marks over Australia's ability to qualify for the World Cup? But we've gotten the result that we needed in World Cup qualification. Other results in the group have gone our way. The picture's looking a lot better for the big picture, which is to qualify for the 2018 World Cup. There was some discussions about, I think Simon mentioned it in his column that he wrote for the website, in the lead up to the Saudi game, saying what a risk it would be if Australia wasn't to make the World Cup. Now, that would have a huge impact on the financial landscape of the game, knowing how much of a cash cow that qualification is. We're better placed for that than we were a week ago, so I think that's a big tick. And as for the Brazil game, it was a friendly game. Australia had a weakened team. Yes, Brazil had a weakened team, but, I mean, it was a blowout in the final 30 minutes, so it's not all to be to be concerned about when the big picture is World Cup 2018 and we're on track for that.
I know you've got some interesting thoughts on the positives that came out of that Brazil game, but Gabby, before we move on to some of the talking points, I just want to touch on something you said about good second half. And this is one of the really interesting things about how polarizing the soccer is at the moment, and I've written a bit about it today on foxsports.com.au. For example, we complain about the form of the side, but they're undefeated going into the Brazil game in 8. We talk about the fact that the side is struggling coherently to score goals, but they had scored in 15 games straight. of course, included in that was the fact they didn't score from open play between the two Saudi Arabia games, but they were finding other avenues towards goal. Concerned about the defence, but it had been 20 home games since Australia had conceded multiple times at home. So it's interesting how there is that sort of split between what looks like there's a brewing issue, but actually where we're at. Best summed up by, you said you were happy with the second half against Saudi Arabia, but if not for a gift first goal, things could have been very, very different in what was a really poor first half, scratchy first half, unable to set the tempo first half. So what do you say to that when you take that performance and have to put that against, say, bigger opposition in the next couple of weeks?
I may be painting a positive picture. No doubt the team is scratchy at the moment. I don't think they're playing at their optimum by any stretch of the imagination. But the second halves in the last three games, Iraq, UAE and Saudi Arabia, have all been pretty positive. So you'd like to think or hope that they will find some better form when they've got their best 11 on a massive stage against big teams at the Confeds Cup. The formation's a big point of that discussion, and that is, you know, at the heart of many of the critics' views. For me, it's still the best formation for this team going forward. I've no doubt about that, because the only way for Australia to get the most avenues towards goal is getting the three best goal scorers in club football in the biggest leagues on that pitch together. And that's Jackson Irvine, Tom Rogic and Aaron Moy. And in that formation, you can get those three in the most dangerous positions. Now, the first half against Saudi was poor defensively for a couple of reasons. Miller Yedinak didn't play well. We've now since found out he had an injury, because he was struggling with the groin injury in that game and he was ruled out the day after. He struggled to give the defence enough protection. Bailey Wright goes out the day before the game. Ryan McGowan spends 50 hours on a flight, and that affects probably his performance as well, coming in from the cold. And defensively, they looked unassured, but they didn't have that protection that you need. Back three, back four. If you don't have any midfield protection, you're in a lot of trouble. And Millet was obviously struggling, and that held the team back. But it's certainly the best formation, because it's the best way for Australia to win games of football, is getting those guys for mine in the park, on the park together in those dangerous position. So there's reason to be encouraged about the move forward in the Confeds Cup and the games we have to play. Dangerous opposition, yes, but I still like to think that in history with Ange Postecoglou, we've managed to rise to the occasion. There was concerns ahead of the World Cup in 2014 and they executed. There were concerns ahead of the Asian Cup in 2015. The same things were being said that we're saying right now, heading into that Asian Cup. A bunch of ordinary performances, really. Draws where he was experimenting a bit.
And Don't forget he changed formation leading into the Asian Cup
as
well.
He did, and he changed plays, and he looked at who would work and who wouldn't, and we went and we won the thing. He's changing things now as well to get us in the best shape to qualify for Russia. We've got the results, maybe without the full 90-minute performances, but if you consider that in the past, it's all managed to work for him. You've got to be optimistic that it will for the games coming up in the next week. And then the final two games of qualification. If it doesn't, we can assess it then. But he's got credit in the bank, so I like to think that it will work out in a positive sense.
Yeah, there's no question about the credit in the bank, and we'll deal with Postecoglou and specifically a little bit later on in this discussion. My concern from the Saudi game with those rich talents that we had in the midfield in the first half was, for probably the fifth or sixth or seventh game in succession, a team that has built itself on this passing mandate of this wanting to dominate in the opposition half. Mm. The talk before the game was all about the midfield and how exciting we are. I think you actually asked the question in the press conference about getting these three, for want of a better phrase, for us Rolls-Royce players in on the park at the same time. But the tempo, the rhythm, the ability to dominate and move the pieces of the opposition puzzle around hasn't quite been there. Mm. So, as you quite rightly said, I think the script is about to get written. The judgment will get passed from what happens from this concerted period of preparation that the side has under Postecoglou, with a week already, week and a half, whatnot, going into another camp in Russia, three games on the bounce. We'll get a really good picture. But my worry is the trend. It's happened now over a couple of games where you go all the way back to probably the UAE qualifier last year, which was probably the last time that Socceroos came out and had a routine performance, where there weren't challenges or probably self-inflicted challenges that had to be overcome within the game. So that's where the jury is out for me. We know that the mandate is to be a possession-based side. The execution
is lacking a little bit now, and over a full 90 minutes.
Yeah, and the challenge there will be different because we're not going to have three teams that are going to sit back and make us force the issue. I felt that there was some confusion, say, for Moy, who's had a wonderful season, alongside Jedinak as deep number sixes against the Sorties. It looked a little bit confused for the first half. But these are the things I'm looking forward to seeing how they're ironed out, particularly in a different circumstance where we are not being told, we're sitting back, you break us down. That's the challenge. And when Brazil presented a similar kind of test, we obviously didn't have all the cattle on the park that we will in these big games. Kate, you had a really good vantage point of the MCG game. You've watched them closely. What's your view on the formation that we've just chatted about?
Well, I think it's also important to mention that they defended a little bit differently against Brazil as they did against Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So in that game, Robbie Cruz, again, in the Brazil game, mm-hmm. Robbie Cruz was acting more as a second number nine next to Cahill. So it was actually a slight tweak on the midfield four that we'd come to expect. In the Brazil game, it was only a midfield three with two up front. So it was a slight difference. But I think the first half performance against Brazil was very good. And it's what we can expect in the Confederations Cup, because it's also what we experienced at the World Cup when Australia was versing really superior opponents. So obviously we remember the Netherlands game where that platform where we nearly caused a shock win came off the back of the way Australia defended. So I think the Brazil game gives us a little bit more insight into what we can expect in the Confederations Cup, because we're not going to be able to see as much of the football, but it's what we do with it that will count. So the Brazil performance, the positives of that was the way Australia defended. Where it fell down was once they were able to win the ball back, they didn't have the cattle on the park to do anything with it. And that's where the challenge will be for Postecoglou with those sessions leading up to the Confederations Cup.
It's funny, you speak about the World Cup and it casts my mind back. You know, there was no indication going into that first game against Chile that Australia would have performed the way they did that night. I remember all the talk was doom and gloom, a couple of friendlies against Saudi South Arabia, Africa here. There was
Ecuador
one over there.
Well.
Ecuador. There was one over there.
Croatia.
Yeah.
Ordinary. And you thought, how on earth are they going to match it against Chile and the Netherlands? And they just rose to the occasion. So there's the intangible side of things as well, to get set for that big stage where they have an excellent culture, a manager who motivates them very well, a game plan that they believe in. And when it's time to execute, they have done in the past. So while people are sitting here thinking, after that game against Brazil, how on earth can we go and match it against Germany? It's been done in the past, so why can't it be done again?
Kate, that formation that was a little bit of a tweak, and it was subtle. So a lot of the bluster and the criticism since and before then has continued on that this three at the back, it's exposing us. We're getting caught with, you know, players, the other teams winning the ball off us in transition and hitting us because we don't have that balance and so on. And as I said, we're going to have different cattle in those positions for the games in the Confederations Cup. But how big a role does this tactical tweak that's subtle, that hasn't necessarily been discussed widely because perhaps, you know, perhaps those observations haven't been made, but how big a role does that have in solidifying and making this back three formation a success, whereas to maybe the common eye at the moment it's seen as a risk?
Well, I think it also touches on a point that Garby just made about mindset and mentality of the Socceroos. So they fundamentally believe that they are capable of matching it against the best opponents in the world. So the way they changed things against Brazil came from their belief that they could dominate Brazil when they didn't have the ball. So they effectively matched up all over the field man for man, and they left themselves 3-on-3 at the back. And they were comfortable with that because they believed that with their quality and intensity of their press that they could win the ball in the right areas and create chances, which they did to an extent, but they also lost the ball a lot in transition. That's a side point. But they have the fundamental belief that they can dominate any opponent based on their structures, based on their mentality. So that's the starting point. And that's what Ange has been really successful at being able to achieve, is to get those group of players who some of us, you know, and you know, many fans across the country would question whether they're good enough. He's able to get them to believe that they are good enough. So the numbers on the park and the formation and what you'll see on the team sheet is really just based off the starting point of their mentality that they want to dominate the opposition. So it was a subtle tweak against Brazil, but it came back to their belief that they could dominate them, and that was the best way for them to do it, to match up against the world's world number one, man for man all over the field.
It didn't quite work in the end, unfortunately.
Didn't quite work the way, but
4-0.
But I have to say, for 44 minutes and 48 seconds, the first half was actually not bad at all, and actually did show signs of progress. And one of the things that I sort of saw from higher up on Adelaide Oval was, and I think was improved on from game to game, so you hope that this improvement goes steadily throughout, is against the Sorties when they were sitting back, there was this imbalance where you had three defenders almost wondering what to do because they were only marking one striker. You often had a wing back who wasn't quite sure when to go. And at times, I took one picture that I tweeted where Leckie was almost in line with McGowan.
Yeah.
And you had Moy and Jednak almost in the centre circle themselves. So there were no two centre-backs pushing up to create that extra man in midfield. Moy was dropping back. And what would happen is, as we know now, Jednak was injured, but he'd lose the ball. And despite these players having 4 5-on-1, we were still getting caught out in the break because there'd still be someone in between the lines. That improved, I think, between games. And that has to be what we hope continues over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's a formation that I think takes more time to adjust to defensively than in an attacking sense. I remember speaking to Matt Leckie after the UAE game in Sydney and saying, how are you adjusting to it? And he said, it is a challenge. He's starting in a much deeper position.
Absolutely.
Ange doesn't want to phrase it as a wing back, but a lot of the time you are. Mm. And he's not used to starting in that deep role, and it's almost taking 45 minutes for him to adjust every single time. You look at the second half performances of the last three games, bar the Brazil one, they've been much better in the second half of games because they're getting used to the formation again. As is Bage, who basically plays that position anyway, steps in straight away and it's fine. For someone like Leckie, who's not used to it, it's a challenge, and for the back three to work out what they're going to do when they don't have the ball. But if you believe that it's the best formation for the team, you've got to go through with it and you've got to keep persisting with it. And he will, no doubt. He's unequivocal in his belief in that regard. And as footballers, they've got to be a little bit better as well. Stop looking at the coach. You know, the modern-day footballer should be able to adjust to a formation in a game. What if two players go down injured? All of a sudden, you have to go to a back three. You've got to be able to make those adjustments. And they're getting better as games are going on. And they will be better for it in the future. But they've got to get better at sharpening up from the start of the game as well, not just after half-time.
The starts are a real concern. And it's funny, after the Japan-Thailand doubleheader, I remember talking to Ange in a one-on-one interview, and when we spoke a lot, and we spoke about the fact that in both games we had two completely different challenges. The first one was the shock of Japan sitting back, and the side didn't necessarily react and didn't know what to do, given that they weren't expecting to have to dominate against a team that was going to retreat and show that sort of difference to what we do. And then in the Thailand game, we just couldn't pass the ball. Yeah. And it was almost two completely different things. But what he wanted to find was a team that could not obviously want them to start well, but could look and find solutions within a game. So in a positive sense, even though I thought the first half against Saudi Arabia just wasn't acceptable, it was very hard to watch. But the positive is that there was that eked out performance in the second half. Okay, in terms of the formation, we've said that we want to put all our cards into where the cattle are, and that's in the midfield. But Garvey mentioned Leckie, and he mentioned Aziz Bajic, mentioned Juric. There's a lot of pressure in throwing all the cards in that basket if there's a few things not go right. First things first, you saw the second tier of player come on against Brazil, and it is a jump from Moy, Rogic, and Irvine. It's also a lot of pressure on your Leckies, Juric's, Sainsbury's, because the next cabs off the rank are not necessarily as strong. So it's really relying on that core 11. How much pressure is this formation putting on? We've spoken about the midfield a lot, but putting on Juric, putting on the wing backs, who it looks like it'll be Bajic and Leckie, and putting on those three centre backs.
Well, it is putting pressure on them because, as we've touched on, they're playing in slightly unfamiliar roles, or they're playing in positions where we don't necessarily have a lot of depth. But if we look at the trajectory of where Australia or how Australia have played in terms of formations over the entire course of Postecoglou's reign, he's gone from a 4-2-3-1 to a 4-3-3. He's tried out a 4-4-2 diamond, which would allow the midfield four. That was to enable Luongo to play with Moy and Rogic. And obviously since then, Jackson Irvine's come on and made a claim for a starting spot. So now we're in this back three formation. But the starting point of all of those formations is the football that Ange wants his team to play. And the principles that underlie that is to have some form of overload in midfield so that we can dominate possession, particularly in the centre of the park. So already you're looking at, if you're starting with three central midfielders, you're looking at how you can get one or both of your wingers to come into central areas to create overloads. The number nine's role has traditionally always been to stay away and stretch the play and look to get on the end of early crosses. So for Juric, that's a good role for him. Mm-hmm. That also suits someone like Tim Cahill.
Yep.
Jamie McLaren, there's been question marks over whether or not he can suit the system, but he's a goal poach, so, you know, he's got goals in him if he gets an opportunity to
try. An option.
An option, absolutely. So, but the core of it is to create overloads in the centre of the park and also to allow one of the centre-backs to be able to drive into midfield, another avenue of creating overloads.
Mm. And that was poor against Saudi Arabia. That's a work
very
in progress.
Poor. Very poor, because you would see some of the passes that Ryan McGowan and whatnot were planning, Milos Degeneg and Trent Sainsbury even was turning the ball over with forward passes into midfield.
It's very funny. You got a back three of Milligan, Spiranovic, Sainsbury. You're looking at that becoming a lot more adaptable than the three that we had on the park that day.
That's a big part of it, without doubt. And even when you've got players like a Bailey Wright next to Sainsbury, which he had against the UAE, and it's you've got someone there who's been in the system a little bit more, then Sainsbury feels more comfortable stepping out with the ball and zoning off to float and then communicate with Bailey Wright in that regard. Bailey Wright goes out, McGowan comes in, it fractures things a little bit more, and that has a bit of an impact. But I agree, I think if Mille Jedinak comes back to full fitness for the Japan game and he's at his best, starts the system the season well in England, Mark Milligan maybe drops back into the back three and you're looking a little bit better about things. There's a question mark over Degeneck right now. I think his performances have been a little bit shaky, and that's probably the one guy on the team that, you know, needs to really prove himself over these next three games. He's got a real big question mark over his head, because defensively he's up and down, but with the ball he seems to be a little bit unsure of himself.
Yeah, I think we'll learn a lot about him in Russia. Sorry, and Kate, we just interrupted you there with a little tangent, but yeah, go on, what were you going to say?
Yeah, so the core principle is to create overloads in the centre of the park. So then once you've been able to achieve that, it's about how you can release forward runs in wide areas. Mm. So in that sense, it better suits someone like Alecki to be playing in a wide wing-back role, if that's what we want to class it, than him trying to play in central areas where that's not his strength. So when we were playing as the 4-3-3, he was having to drop into the little pockets of space in midfield to try to pick the ball up or combine. His strength is offering with forward runs and delivery into the box. And then when the Socceroos moved into a diamond formation, he was having to play out of position as one of the two number nines in order to accommodate him. So I think it suits someone like Alecki better. For someone like a Juric, it's a role that he's comfortable with, as Garby mentioned. Bajic is comfortable in that role. So I don't necessarily think that the formation takes away from the strengths of other players. I think it can or has the potential to complement all of the players. It's just whether or not we can get the best players available on the park, fit, with minutes under their belt and ready to play. Yeah. That's where the challenge comes.
And like any team in the world, there's a reliance on your best 11 and maybe the few under that. And as we know, and one of the challenges and one of the mitigating circumstances and the wider issues we need to talk about is the cattle available. And you can only do so much with the cattle available. I went to try pick, when the selections happened, a second 11 or an unlucky losers from the outside of the squad, particularly around the conversation with Robbie Cruz, to a lesser extent Trent Sainsbury, and Brad Smith from his time at Bournemouth this season, where he got very little game time. And that's where it really exposes the challenge that Postecoglou has with this 11 and what the Socceroos have been building for the last couple of years, which was meant to peak with us, you know, at a crescendo over from now until the next World Cup, with players humming towards the peak of their careers. That hasn't necessarily happened. So what you're dealing with is trying to get the best out of an 11 where there's wider issues at play, why we don't have more players knocking at the door, why the youth teams aren't presenting more players coming through the ranks. It's a wider discussion than this one, but an important point to raise when looking at the hysteria and the question marks over the current Socceroos side. And just to touch on one other thing that I like about what you just mentioned, Kate, is with Lecky, it takes the goal-scoring burden off him as well. I know he scored twice in that last qualification double, but it's great if it's a bonus, if we're not relying on him, and you get to see him express himself. And he is a very important player when confident for Australia, with a tremendous work rate, tremendous energy and desire. And there was one moment in the Brazil game where, he misplaced a few passes, and there was one moment where he didn't buy the right byline, and he fizzed back to make sure that he won it close to the halfway line, and that's absolutely crucial to make sure that you're getting the most out of your players in their most confident moods.
Yeah, Matty will be important. He's up and down. He frustrates people at times because his touch is not exactly exquisite, and sometimes he can be like a bit of a bull in a china shop. It's head down, and he's running forward without enough composure about things, and that's understandable that it frustrates people. Interested to watch him against Germany, a nation he knows so well, and now that he's moved to a big club in Hertha Berlin. You know, Tommy Urich was the big success story out of this week, just from that one game against Saudi Arabia. We've been talking for so long about finding a number nine. He put in a top-quality performance. Everyone goes, oh, I was lucky with the first goal. That's hard to execute. You know, it comes in, it fizzes at him, he's not really ready, his body position's poor. He controls it beautifully with one foot and volleys it home from a fair way out with the other. It's not a gimme by any stretch. You can see a lot of those being missed. So, you know, that helped his confidence, and then he puts away a second, which he should do, but he did. He delivered. So, and his overall performance was excellent. He shouldered the burden up front. When the midfield wasn't clicking, when the ball went to him, he managed to take control and play pretty well. We've now got someone who's got that shirt and fits the formation pretty much nailed down. McLaren, as we know, is a bit more of an in-behind type player. He wants the balls through rather than coming towards it. And Timmy is an impact player now. So that position's nailed down. And the other two, McLaren and Cahill, will work off you, Rich, throughout the tournament, I suspect. So that's an encouraging part of the week as well. He may not be Mark Viduka, but he's someone there that you can put in and rely upon right now, considering his end to the season in Switzerland as well.
You know what? He's actually growing in confidence, which is really important. I loved what he said after the game in the press conference, where they talked about the two gifts he received against Saudi Arabia. He went, that second one, I was away from the defender for a reason. Yeah, you know, exactly. I had to be on his blind side, and that's why he didn't get me, and that's why I put it away. So positive there. Excellent Lecky cross, excellent header, and that's the finishing we want. Now, one of the other big burning questions, you mentioned the word belief before. Now, Postecoglou came out yesterday and said, we're going to go to win the Confederations Cup. I mean, the bravado and the rhetoric has not died down through all the criticism, but there has been some prickliness from within the Socceroos camp. Trent Sainsbury led that. Postecoglou tried to play it down afterwards, but there's no doubt that this growing criticism, and it has come from, some of it has been uneducated, some of it has been just throwing stones from beyond the football landscape. Others have been football commentators and pundits who have taken exception to the formation. Conversation is good. It's healthy. Yeah. I had to turn my phone over during one of the games because all my friends were bombarding or WhatsApps around discussing the state of the Socceroos, and that's healthy because they don't necessarily always do that, and I think that's what we're finding. But I don't think the narrative around Postecoglou has ever been as central as... it's always been dominant, but it's really central and polarizing now because of the fact that he is not relenting from this mantra. And he said yesterday, we're either going to... I can't remember the quote exactly.
Spectacular failure or spectacular success.
And there's no middle ground. So...
Nor should he. Well, why should he back down from it? You know, like... Firstly, in the Confederations Cup, you get through your group, you're playing in the semi-final. So the whole ideal that it's impossible to win it is a little bit unfair as well. I mean, yeah, you managed to get a win and a draw, you threw on goal difference, you're one game off the final. So, and we've been there twice before, 97 and 01. So I don't think there's any reason why we shouldn't have the goal of winning it. And people might think that's fanciful, but you know, you've got to dream big. And why would he waver now after we've performed well in a World Cup, won an Asian Cup, on track for automatic qualification now? There's nothing, while the performances may be a little bit fractured overall in the big picture of things, there's nothing to say it's impossible to or you should change that belief. So why don't, I think it's great that he's maintaining that. He's a little bit grumpy right now, and he's a bit annoyed with it. On Trent Sainsbury should check his comments, because I hate it when players say you should be supporting us. Remember Harry Kewell saying it at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa? It's probably been said a couple of times since. Trent said it the day before the game. No, we're reporters, not supporters. That's the way it is. And you call that as you see it. Everyone wants the Socceroos to do well. Of course, we're all fans of the team. But you call that as you see it. And they've always been players, and Andrew's the one who started it, who called for analysis of the team. He called for harsh criticism of players in the A-League and harsh analysis of things so that we can improve as a football nation. We are doing that now. They may not like it as much because it's falling on them, but we're doing that now. And I know Ange, in the cold light of day, would rather have that than not. And perspective may be lacking a little bit when it comes to the things that I mentioned, the World Cup and the Asian Cup, and maybe that's where they get a little bit annoyed. But you know, that debate is overall very healthy, and they're the ones who called on it, so they shouldn't arc up when it comes.
it is an important debate to have, and it is healthy to be talking about the national team. And we also have to remember, so if the fans are criticising Postecoglou for being positive and being ambitious and wanting the best for the country, what's the alternative message that he puts out there? That we're going to go up against three quality oppositions at the Confederations Cup. We're going to sit back against Brazil. Mm. We're going to drop back into a block. We're going to defend for our lives, and we're going to be plucky and try to cause an upset. Because that was the end of the spectrum that we so greatly wanted to move away from when we appointed him.
Yeah.
And from day one, he's always come in and always been adamant that this team would be ambitious. And that was one of his main mantras that has continued throughout his entire time in charge, of that this national team would take the game to the opposition. So I think we need to question ourselves of what do we want the national team to stand for? Do we want them to be someone who actually is, as a collective, is ambitious and wanting to prove themselves against the best? Or do we just want to return to those days of passive play, dropping back and hoping for a result? Because I think ultimately that's what we moved away from. So why are we now criticising the outcome?
As three people who've had the pleasure of interviewing Andrew, watching the Socceroos from close quarters, that I couldn't agree more. Except, what about just that little bit? And this is the contrarian argument that's out there. Why the spectacular failure? Why not at the moment where that spectacular success looks like it might just be that little bit far reached? Why in the game is there no, or why in the game plan is there not, or in the mantra is not, well, we're going to be where we need to be, just that little bit more pragmatic, or just change tack, or just do something that's a little bit alternative. What about that balance?
When you look at his press conferences and some of the things he says, you also have to split it up into the perspective that one half of his press conference is talking to his players, the other half of the press conference is talking to the critics. And ultimately, there's a bit of a division because the rhetoric around the Socceroos has started to turn negative, so it started to become more critical. So a lot of the comments that he makes that come across as harsh and grumpy and critical, that's really a hit back at the critics. So those little comments that he made in the press conference yesterday where he was asked about the Japan result, and he snapped back straight away and said, I'm sure they're going to throw out their national curriculum. That's a dig, in his mind, at the critics. The very next response, he says, it's in our hands. You know, we've never been better placed. This is ours. We're going to be ambitious. That's him talking to his players, because within the playing group, he's built a culture of belief. So he needs to speak to that. And that's why you see someone like Trent Sainsbury coming out and questioning the media for being critical, because within that group, they've got a bit of a siege mentality brewing where all of a sudden there's criticism from the outside, but inside they don't feel it. So they question it. So there's part of it that talks to the players, and there's part of it that talks to the perceived critics, whether they're real or perceived. But there is a divide in the language that he uses, which is perhaps why people are getting confused, saying you wanted criticism, but now you're getting it and you're calling it out. So what do you want? Because there is a portion, it's kind of like a split personality in a sense, where some of it he's talking to his players, building their belief and building their mentality. And the other ones, he's dropping little hints to say, well, hey, guys, come on. And I'm going to have a go back at you. There's this little bit of a divide going, which is interesting. And it will be interesting to follow as well, going through the remainder of the Confederations Cup and also for the World Cup qualifying, to see if he's able to find some middle ground where he's able to hit both parties with the one message. Because at the moment, his messaging is a little bit divided.
Mm. Also, what do you gain from going there? And as Kate said, being pragmatic about it all and trying to eke out it. Well, what do you actually achieve moving forward? If you want to get the best out of these guys and get them to the next level, which everyone craves, they have to go out and try and match it with the best. You know, Greece won a Euros by sitting back and they won the tournament, amazing, and a memory for the rest of their lives, and no one will ever take it away. But have they advanced as a football nation or anything like that in terms of the way they play? They've probably gone backwards really overall. And it was the freakiest performance of all time, and everyone remembers that tournament so vividly. But you know, if you want to move forward as a football nation, you've got to try and match it with the trends in modern football. And we're doing that with our formation now, and ask the players to try and match it with the best in terms of the way they play as well. Rise to their standards. And over the journey with Ange, they have managed to do so more often than not.
So the pragmatism isn't a tactic from the start of the game, but it's the ability to adapt in-game. So I ask you this, hypothetically, and we hope this isn't a conversation we are having, what if we fall to the spectacular failure side of it, where it's not just 4-0, it could be more, it could be less, but it's three performances where it hasn't worked? What happens if we have this conversation at the start of August?
You only fall to spectacular failures and get absolutely pumped if you lose belief in the manager and the system. With your best team out there on a big stage, if you lose 6 or 7 or 8 nil, that's because you've almost given up. This team, just because they're not sitting back and parking the bus, doesn't mean they're not being defensively ruthless in terms of the way they press and the way they try and cover and the way they try and... There's different ways of defending. It's not just about sitting back and sitting deep. If they get pumped 7 or 8 nil, then they maybe have lost some belief in the system, and then you start questioning those things. But I can't see that happening in these games because of the mantra in that football side. You know, we watched it against France and Brazil when Holger Rosick was in charge. You knew then they'd lost belief in their system. There's none of that going on. So if it happens, then of course you ask questions about where they're going and if they lose 7 or 8 nil. But that won't happen. That won't happen with that team, with that mentality, with the depth of tactical analysis in that team as well.
If you talk about on the side of spectacular success versus spectacular failure, with their belief, they believe they can achieve the results against the best teams in the Confederations Cup. The only risk of them having spectacular failure is if their mindset wavers and if there becomes a divide where they question. So you come away from a 4-0 loss against Brazil, the world's best. You ask James Troisi, there was also an interview with Tim Cahill, what were the players' response? They were saying the game plan was good. The game plan was good. Their message was the exact same as Postecoglou. There was no... They didn't go into the dressing room and have a debrief and go, all right, here's your little script that you're going to go off and read to the press.
Yeah.
That was immediately after the game, and everyone was on the same page. So that's what he's been able to create. That's the culture he's been able to create, where they're all on the same page. The only way that turns into spectacular failure is if people within the culture, within the group, start to not believe anymore. That's the risk.
And you look at the game against France, that 6-0 game, when you sensed it happening under Holger Rosick, what do they complain about? Refereeing decisions. You know, that was the... And then we heard from players after the game saying, you know, why was I playing in this position? I remember Mille Jedinak saying, I don't believe I've been given the tools to do my job properly. Things like that. They're not even close to that in this set. No,
you had a really divided unit when Postecoglou came in, there was questions from some senior players as to who are these youth players or the younger players that are starting to break in. So there was a divide. So he's been able to move from a divided camp and a camp that looks to externalize results to all of a sudden one that genuinely believes in the process that they're going through, and they believe that that process will achieve a positive outcome.
So until they get to that stage, there's no spectacular failure likely.
Yeah, and what's another part of it that we haven't touched on, but we'll only just mention it, is it's not just the playing group. I mean, we're fortunate to sort of get a sense of the camp on and off the park from being away and talking to people in the setup, and there's various different departments within the setup and the backroom staff, and no matter what role they play, they steadfastly believe that their part of it is part of this system and this structure that is walking towards a plan that is about to work. And so in that sense, it's actually very inspiring to see the belief that they have and that they're able to put out this discussion and put it out of their minds and continue to just be so focused on the goal at hand. But you know, I just want to ask you, Gabi, because you've probably interviewed Ange as much as anyone, arguably the country, in these one-on-ones you do after the press conference and whatnot. And I mean, regardless, Saudi Arabia, scratchy performance, he comes off and says that was progress. Then he talks about the age of the team, and as Kate said, there is a sort of a constant, you can just see the ulterior message, the ulterior motive that's going on. But there are times in the last, I'd say, year where he has been cranky, where he's been angry. What do you sense gets him most riled up? Or when he comes to you after a press conference where you can see he's most agitated, that sort of gives a really good insight into the team
or the outside noise?
Both.
Yeah, I think with the team, it's definitely when they, regardless of the result, don't perform. When they don't execute the passing game that he wants, that's what really gets him annoyed. If they go out and play that sort of game and take it to the opposition, he's delighted. I remember when we drew against Germany 2-2 in Kaiserslautern, and he couldn't hide his excitement because of the way they played that night and just took it up to a big team. England as well, over there in Sunderland. The result to him didn't matter. It was signs of progress in the way they were playing. In terms of the other side of things, what really gets him annoyed, I think it's when people lack perspective in the discussion. You know, when they simply nitpick at a couple of little things and make headline statements without putting the proper framework in. And I remember him getting really annoyed before the Asian Cup when you know, Raleigh Rasic, who's a bit of a rent a quote at times. We love his contribution to the game, but, you know, he can often fire up every now and again. And he had a crack at Ange, and that got him annoyed only because the people framing that argument on the back of that, you know, failed to look at Ange's history and what he did with his A-League teams. And now it's when people are having a go at him, they failed to look at what he did leading into the World Cup, what he did leading into the Asian Cup. If you put some perspective with it, I think he'd be okay. It's when people have little pot shots without doing that, that angers him a bit. And to be honest, that's probably justifiable.
It's really interesting, the insights that you just gave, because if you were to map him out in terms of what type of a leader he was, because ultimately a coach or a manager, they're a leader of a group of people, he's on the visionary end of the spectrum. So that's why you get the ambitious messages, you get the belief that brews within the organisation or within the squad. And all throughout his time, so from Brisbane Roar, he gave them this vision that they could be the best team that Australia's ever seen. And he, depending on where you stand in the debate, most would say he achieved that, where Brisbane Roar helped to move the A-League in a direction that no other team had gone. He then tried to do similar with Melbourne Victory, but obviously his tenure was cut short before he took over the Socceroos. But still, he's able to create this vision for the team, and also he's attempting to create a vision for the wider football population to see that this is the direction that we can go. So it's interesting that he seems to become his most grumpy, in a sense, or he seems to hit back the most when someone tries to undermine that. Because... I'm not inside his head, but perhaps he's got such strong vision for where the game can go. When someone tries to undermine that vision or tries to destroy the culture that he's creating, he becomes a protector. So it's interesting. And I think you can't isolate his press conferences from his entire leadership, his entire just basic personality, because it's all intertwined. And you look at the culture that he's been able to build, and he's only been able to do that by getting 100% buy-in from all of these people with various different motivations that they can achieve a certain outcome.
And one of the other challenges that he has to put up with, and one of the things I have asked him in the past, is you can deal with a building like Fox Sports, where the landscape we've got to talk is a bit more in depth, and there's a bit more knowledge. You're talking with former Socceroos. Or he's going to go on mainstream media promoting brand Socceroo, brand football, the game, and he's going to get 30 seconds, 90 seconds, and been asked the most inane question and have to come up with an answer and hope that doesn't get misquoted and somehow come across in that correct light. So it's also the multitude of challenges that come across in this role, where it's not just coach, it's politician, it's Pied Piper, it's chairman, chief executive, board member, captain, coach, bus driver, kit man, and everything in terms of pushing it forward. So it's a fascinating matrix, and that's why we've taken the time now to break out with this podcast and have a bit of a chat that hopefully you've all enjoyed in terms of where are we really at. And you mentioned one word, Garby, perspective. And in conclusion, I just want to get you both to, and I'll say something as well, on has perspective been lost in the last week, 2 weeks, month, or so?
I think it's been lost for a little while in terms of how far we've come. You look at the period under Holger Osic, where we are now, what we've done in that time, Asian champions. You know, people want to pick it part of the results of the World Cup. I don't buy into that. When you look at the squad we had, the expectations before, the teams we were playing, for goodness sakes. Yeah, we were saved by a couple of great Tim Cahill moments, but on the pitch, they matched it with two outstanding teams in Chile and the Netherlands in terms of the way we actually played the game. So you look at that journey and where we are right now in qualifying, little performances will waver up and down with every team. And yes, people have a right to be angry about it and ask questions. That's the passion. That's what we want. That's interest. But when analysing him and his performances, just look at what's been done before. And if after the World Cup qualifying campaign or after the Confederations Cup, those results change dramatically, then fair enough. But right now, perspective-wise, we should be encouraged that we can match it with Germany, Chile and Cameroon in the Confederations Cup, and confident that we will qualify automatically for Russia.
If we can match it with the current cattle that we have on the park and available to the national team, and with the young state that the A-League is in, and we're also having all of these other debates that still come into the discussion with national teams about second division youth development. They're all bigger picture discussions.
Resources,
absolutely. But if we're able to achieve a Socceroos outcome whereby they are able to match it against Germany, Cameroon and Chile, and potentially, as Garby said, they get a win and a draw, and they're through to the semi-finals. From there, anything can happen. If they're able to do that, that should be the little trigger for everyone in Australian football to get on the same page, just like Andrew's been able to achieve with the Socceroos, to ensure that Australian football can move forward in the right direction. Because imagine if we've got all the different cogs of the machine working together and working smoothly, what we can actually achieve when we've got the next golden generation coming through to for the next coach to take forward with this collective mindset, knowing that we can do it with these players. What can we do when we've got our next golden generation coming through?
Do you know what's actually lost a little bit is that the overachievement through that sort of gallant defeat at the World Cup to the Asian Cup with a bunch of players that were taken to another level. And over the course of a long period of time with travel and club commitments and just human nature, it's not necessarily possible to maintain that kind of level. Tournament play will expose that and we'll see where we're at. But we can also lose sight because of the benchmark that was set within the reality of what we're working with over the next couple of years. It's really tough. And for me, I think the script is going to be written. I think we've got to have these discussions, but it's almost a little bit premature because I think we're going to see the proof in the pudding, the walk, the talk over the coming weeks. And we'll be able to have a proper evidence-based discussion after the Confederations Cup is over. I firmly believe that all of this rhetoric, we're all going to see what it's going to amount to in Russia over the coming weeks. To end off, guys, if this was the usual Fox Football Club podcast and Adam was here, he'd throw to a prediction. Want you just have a look at the very immediate crystal ball. It doesn't have to be specific, just want to know. Hopes, high, low, medium, Confederations Cup, when we regroup to face Japan on, I think it's August 31, for a massive World Cup qualifier. Is the confidence going to be high, or are we going to be still reflecting?
I think they'll be in a better position. I think that they'll go up a level on the big stage for the Confeds Cup. What happens in terms of where we finish, I don't know. I think the second game against Cameroon is a crucial one. You know, Germany, who knows what sort of German mentality will be produced. I mean, they're always strong in that regard. They've got a lot of pride, but they've sent a slightly weakened side, but it's still full of talent,
but so it is a weakened side.
That's tricky. I think we can beat Cameroon, and that's the big one. And then if you manage to snare a draw against Germany in the first game or Chile in the last game, maybe you can get through. I think Chile's actually my tip to win it, so I think that's going to be a very difficult ask. But you know, maybe we can get a draw against them, maybe against Germany, and manage to get through. I think we can beat Cameroon, and then whatever happens after that is you know, it doesn't really matter too much. If we can put in, you know, a couple of very good performances, we'll be in a very good position confidence-wise going into that in that Japan game. And either way, I think we can go to Japan and get a result, and then we'll beat Thailand in the last game and get through automatically.
And that the three games in the group will be that opportunity to provide perspective, because a good performance against Germany, even if it is a spectacularly close loss, that will gain perspective of, hey, we're actually not that far off, although the Brazil game suggested it. There's three games there to prove that we're not that far off the next level. And then qualifying for the World Cup will allow us to have another opportunity to prove ourselves against the best. So I think the three games in the Confederations Cup group stage will allow us to just remind ourselves that actually we're not a country mile off. The team is overperforming. And when they do overperform to their best, they can cause some upsets.
The Cameroon one's a really big one, because we've often talked about Brazil, Germany, Chile as our big challenge. But to go out and get a win against the African champions, Asian champions against the African champions, I think that's actually one of the really important KPIs of the Confederations Cup coming up, or at least a very, 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 very competitive performance against them in context. I'm yet to see Australia underwhelm under Postecoglou at a major tournament, and I'm not going to will it to happen in this one.
It's big for players, of course, to put themselves on a big stage and the world to be watching, and a couple of big performances. Who knows what can happen in terms of club moves. For Ange as well. I mean, he's been honest in saying that after this World Cup campaign, he wants to go into club management again, and probably in Europe. The World Cup will be the big indicator of that. But this is a little audition for him as well. I mean, Australia can make it out of the group, maybe get to a final like in 97 and 2001. His stocks will rise as well. And I'm sure that's not his sole motivation, but at the back of his mind, and understandably so, there's no crime in that. He'd be thinking, well, this can help things for me going forward. He's been honest about his plans. He's not being scurrilous about it. So, you know, it's exciting to see if he can prove things. We can maybe go one step further to that next frontier, which is getting an Australian coach in a massive European Absolutely. Club.
Yeah, any tournament like this to be involved in on the world stage is a privilege. It's a shop window, no question. It also means that the football continues on and rumbles on, which means, Kate, for you and I, the workload continues. We'll be there over the next couple of weeks covering
it.
I don't remember when the off-season was. I think today was the off-season. I think today was the one day of the off-season that we had on foxsports.com.au. But we'll bring that all for you. Guys, that was fun. Very serious, but very fun.
Very in depth. Lots Kate's to discuss. Tactical knowledge is just scaring me at times.
Well, look, I hope you guys enjoyed the discussion. And we had a lot of fun doing it. And yeah, there'll be plenty of wall-to-wall Socceroos coverage over the coming weeks. And until the next podcast, which I should add, we do have a special treat for you coming up because Adam Peacock has been busy. We didn't have him here today, but he has been recording a series of youth development in-depth podcasts with some key talent that we'll unveil over the next weeks for you as well. So get through this show, and then we'll have the first edition of that next week. And until then, sorry, Kate, were you going to say something? No? You're just packing up. All right, we've had enough. Enjoy
See you,
your football,
Kate. I'll
everyone.
See you, Disco.
Bye. Cheers.